Welcome to What Happened Next, a podcast about new-ish books. My name is Nathan Whitlock, and I'm a writer. On this podcast, I speak to other writers about what happens when their new book is no longer new, and it's time to write another one. I've already had a lot of great conversations about the weirdness and pleasure of being a writer, so please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you do enjoy these episodes, which go up every Monday morning without fail, please tell other people about them. I do this on my own, so it helps a lot. If you want to send me a suggestion for a future guest, or comment on an episode, or just find out more about what I am doing, I have books of my own, hint, hint, please go to nathanwhitlock.ca. This episode marks 1 year of the What Happened Next podcast. I am very grateful for everyone who has listened to these conversations and said nice things to me about them. I'm grateful for Alex Lukashevsky for letting me use part of his song as my theme. And I'm especially grateful for all of the authors who agreed to let me throw questions at them at a time when they are technically off the clock. There is some very good news coming soon about the future of this podcast, but since the details have not been finalized as of yet, for now, I can only say that it does have a future, and it's a good one. My very special guest on this one-year anniversary episode is Megan Strymas. Megan is the author of three collections of poetry, including Junkman's Daughter and A Good Time Had by All, which was shortlisted for the 2011 ReLit Award. She is the editor of The Selected Gwendolyn McEwen and co-edited the Another Dysfunctional Cancer Poem anthology with the late Priscilla Uppel. Megan is a professor in the Faculty of Media and Creative Arts at Humber College, where she runs the Bachelor of Creative and Professional Writing degree. Megan also happens to be married to me, and we talk about that. Megan's most recent book is Yes or Nope, published by Mansfield Press in 2016, and which was awarded the Trillium Book Award for poetry in the following year. Author Zoe Whittle said of that book that the poetry in Yes or Nope is whip-smart and tender-hearted, funny and alive. Megan and I talk about the shift that happened in her writing that allowed her to write Yes or Nope under some very difficult circumstances and time constraints, about working on the final books by her friends Priscilla Uppel and Tava Harrison, books that, in both cases, were published posthumously, and about her new work, which she says further develops the stylistic freedoms she discovered in Yes or Nope, and which will pay tribute to some of the writers who have inspired her. Even though we are married, and we've been married for a while, and we've known each other for a long time, even though that's a little bit of a strange situation with me interviewing you, I think we can be completely professional about this, and I can just ask you questions about writing and your career.
Of course, I'm always professional.
Yeah, I know that. But I do want to start with this thought. When I was talking to you yesterday about the podcast and you said, well, what kind of questions are you going to ask me? I said, well, the usual ones, you know, you listen to the podcast.
Said, you know, I don't listen to podcasts.
You just stared at me.
It's nothing personal. I mean, I've listened to a few of them and I think they're fantastic, though I have nothing to compare them to.
So my first question is really, should partners support each other in their creative ventures?
Well, one partner does. I would say that you're my biggest supporter.
I actually had a thought about that, which is I remember when we were first starting to date each other, you gave me a copy of your book, Junkman's Daughter. Mm-hmm. I've written about this, so it's public, but I remember being a little nervous because you know that feeling of like, if the person...
Don't like it?
Yeah, the person you're in the process of falling in love with turns out to be a hack. Yeah. It gets a little difficulty.
Like you're embarrassed for them.
And what actually happened was, and I remember because I remember reading it in the bath. And by the end of it, I was jealous. And I thought, oh, okay, she can do things that I can't. She's going to places that I would love to be able to go. And I don't do that naturally. And I'm still jealous of what you can do I do feel, though, that your voice and your approach has shifted a lot. There are certain consistent things through all of your collections, but your voice has shifted quite a bit. And I feel like the voice and approach that you take in Yes or No, it feels freer. It feels lighter, not in a sense of it's insubstantial or it's not worth taking seriously, but it just feels like it's coming at the reader more directly. What would you ascribe that shift to? Is it just the circumstances? Can you describe the circumstances a bit? Because you've written about those, or was it where partly just your reading and where you were in your life?
Well, I think like part of it is maturity in that and confidence. I think the first book really, like, I was really just figuring things out for myself. I was really interested in telling stories through verse, which, in some ways I was criticized for, but I have no issue with that and I've kept with it. And then the second book, I think I was really interested in playing with different forms that didn't suit my voice and my style.
What forms and what kind of things were you doing?
I wrote like villanelles and I was really, just sort of busted up sonnets and stuff like that. And I feel like I was applying certain constraints, like syllabics and whatnot, that I didn't, I could have started out with those in early drafts, but then just blew them all apart. And then when it came to the third book, I was less interested in what other people thought, for sure, and more interested in just creating a kind of world for myself while I was writing. Like, I was really immersed in it, and it was a quicker book to write. Sort of more fast and furious because I was a parent by then and I had just less time to write, like really very little time. And you likely remember too that you were very sick at that time.
Right.
So it was basically Stuart Ross, who's a great writer and editor, and had asked me if I would publish the book with him and with the press Mansfield that he was working with at that time. I wasn't completely sure that it was a great idea because of everything that was going on in our lives at that time.
Did you just feel like I can't pull this off, or you just didn't want to sit and do work, or like do that, sit and do writing?
I wanted to write. I just didn't believe that I could make the time to do it. And then basically, I found the time. And it just sort of was something that I prioritized in some ways, maybe even a few hours every day. And I think one gift was that my dad manages a trailer park up in Bruce County, and I was able to write for a couple of weeks in this old sort of abandoned trailer that was had recently been sold, but that was empty. It was one of my dad's friends, and I would go into this little trailer. Well, my mom looked after very kindly. My mother looked after our little guy, and you were recovering from a pretty brutal multiple rounds of chemo and radiation. But I would go into this sort of, I would say, smelly little trailer, and I'd have a hard boiled egg and apple lunch packed. I quit smoking by then, but I was still wrapped up in Nicorette gum. So I'd have a sleeve Nic gum and a bunch of books and my laptop. And it was sort of glorious, right? Like, there were chainsaws ripping all around me and people having their early morning drinks and so forth. It was an actual, it was a trailer park, but it somehow worked for the book. And just having that time and that ability to really sit, read, write, sit again, write, sometimes have a nap, I'm not gonna lie. A nap and a snack, get back up. And so that, I think, produced, a kind of place that I could really focus and wrap the book up in a way. I had a lot of it written, but as like, there needed to be some new poems for, just a different range and whatnot. And then I needed to go in and edit a lot of them. And I remember Stuart was giving me good edits at that point too. And I was going back in and sort of pulling things apart and reworking them. And it was a really lovely thing to, it was a kind of, self-made writing retreat. And I think the only kind of writing retreat that I could probably do, because I'm not great in sort of more formal environments where I might be expected to sit with a group of people and workshop and that kind of thing. I really like to sort of just go at it on my own.
Have you done, I don't actually know this, have you done writing retreats before? Did you go to Banff or places like that?
I went to Banff for a week when I was really young. I have a wealthy uncle who was interested in me as a writer, and he thought I should go to Banff. And so I did. It was pretty neat in that I met a couple of really great writers. And but as usual with me, I ended up getting really bad food poisoning from some tofu. And so I was like bedridden for 3 days. And so it was basically, I had this great setup and I was really sick. But but I'm not a person, I think, that would really do well with retreats. Or maybe I just have to give myself that chance. I tend to sort of like a lot of quiet.
Knowing everything I know about you and knowing your work and your process, being in an empty trailer in Bruce County, surrounded by like chainsaws and people having smokes and drinks, and you got your neck gum and a hard-boiled egg, it just makes a lot more sense than if you were in like Florence, Italy, or in the mountains or something. I'm interested in something you said about yes or nope, which is that you were caring less about what people thought of you. And jumping back a bit for the second collection, for A Good Time Had by All, those formal experiments, was that a bit of a reaction to the what people were saying about the previous collection, that maybe you were too much of a storyteller, or this wasn't real poetry, if you're not doing these abstract experiments? Was that a bit of a reaction to be like, no, look, I can do this capital P poetry
It's
thing?
funny. I don't think anyone reacted to the first book. Like a lot of first books of poetry, it came and went. I don't even think it made a blip. I think I actually felt pretty confident with that first book. But then I think when you put out a first book, you realize that, especially a first book of poetry with a really small press, that you realize that you just continue to be a real nobody, right? And then, should you venture on and finish another book, I think it means you're really into it, right? You're sort of sold and you're stuck with it. But with the second book, I think it was more what was going on around me, sort of in the Canadian writing community at that time. Like it was Ken Babstock had just, through Anansi, released like new formal poetry, and there was just a lot of pressure, I think, for Canadian poets in particular to be writing in form. I think it was considered cool, right? And I know that sounds sort of really pathetic and boring, but for a younger poet at the time, I was looking up to people like Karen Soley and Ken Babstock and whatnot. And so I think I applied certain pressures on myself, or to the work, that maybe didn't need to be there, that hampered it in some ways. And by the time I got to the third book, I just didn't care anymore. I just wanted to write what I wanted to write, which is so freeing. And I think I got closer to the way I'm supposed to write. And I think when you shake off some of, that external pressure and you just really start to embrace what your strengths are as a writer, then better things happen. Like, I look at certain writers and I would think, like, why can't I do that? And it's just something that maybe I'll never be able to do, but I have my thing that I can do. You have your thing that you can do. And I think if you play to your strengths as a writer, then generally speaking, it will be a stronger book, hopefully.
Yeah, and I feel like that's another sign of maturity when you just sort of abandon trying to like be other writers.
And I think it's okay to try and be like other writers in the beginning. Like, imitation is a way of learning, and I'm not ashamed of anything I've put out there, but I'm certainly, I feel closer to, yes or no in terms of what I'm proud of.
Responding to what you just said about, first books of poetry going out in the world and getting no response, I do have to quote something by Gwendolyn McEwen, which you have quoted yourself, which is the line, "For we are great statements in our days, and on the basis of that, we can expect small audiences."
I love that.
Speaking of Gwendolyn McEwen, when was it that you were asked to edit the Gwendolyn McEwen
So
collection?
that was right after my first book, Junkman's Daughter, came out. That was through Exile Editions. And Rosemary Sullivan wrote the intro. And I spent a long time reading all McEwen's work. And I didn't even own all of her work, and I couldn't get access to it all. So I spent a lot of time at the Toronto Reference Library and different libraries at that time. just reading and thinking and compiling. And out of that came the selected Gwendolyn McEwen. And there was a lot of tough, there is a publisher that owns rights to some of, I think, McEwen's best work. And it was so impossible to use any of that work in the selected that I think, unfortunately, there are huge gaps. Margaret Atwood put out years before the sort of renewed selected, a two-volume selected of McEwen's work. And then years later, I did. And I think in both instances, no one was able to get access to some, the Eliot poems and things like that. And I worked closely with her sister Carol at the time, who's lovely, and actually came to the launch of it. And it was a really beautiful night, rainy but packed and whatnot. But it was, always tinged with a kind of sadness, knowing that in the background there was all this beautiful work that couldn't be included in a volume of her poetry, which really should be representative of her sort of oeuvre. And but it was because of different rights and impossible fees that this particular publisher wanted for the work. Just impossible. Like, no one could afford them.
That experience of putting that selected together, is that something that you would ever want to do again, or was that so difficult that maybe not?
I loved it. I loved doing that. And honestly, I've spoken a couple times about putting together a kind of selected of Pris Eppel's work. I'd love to do that, but I think not right now would be, and I'm sure maybe someone else would like to do that too, so I'd be more than happy for someone else to sort of take that on. But at some point I would like to, but I think I need some more time to sort of grieve that loss before I want to really return to that work. But going through someone's work and really getting close to it and thinking about what best represents their talents and sort of their themes and whatnot is fascinating, right? And you can really sort of, and they end up really influencing you. So you have to sort of shake some of that off too. And it's not a bad thing to be influenced by someone like Gwendolyn McEwen, of
Did
course.
you find you were starting to write poems in with a bit of McEwen in them?
I think so. I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that I still go back to her work all of the time. And even with first year intro students in creative writing, I always bring in at least one McEwen poem to share with them. And there's always a few students that really connect with her work, especially I think the classic, like Dark Pines Underwater. That's outrageously, like, well-crafted, beautiful poem. It's so haunting. And there's always a couple students that really take to it and then become fans, which is so neat to think that even now, when her work isn't really sung and praised the way it was, even when I put that selected together at that time, that there are still people loving it and reading it.
Yeah, I can say that. I mean, we, in our capacity as teachers, we teach a lot of the same students because I teach in your program in the spring. This past semester, I had my students, who are also your students, do an assignment where they take a book that is very popular or well known or canonical or whatever, and they take another book that they think should kind of replace it or be read instead of. And one of the students argued for a Gwendolyn McEwen collection to replace, I believe it was like a Rupi Kaur collection
I
as
bet you I know what student that is.
you probably do. I remember
Oh,
seeing that
that's
and
so
thinking like,
nice.
oh, I know whose fingerprints are on this. I know why this is what who planted
That's
the
a
seed of
good
that
thing.
one. Oh, it's great.
Let's get some real poetry going.
I
No offense. I know Rupi Kaur has tons of
knew
fans.
you were going to go back and,
Yeah, I
and
think that's
double.
great. It's just not for me. It's too thin for me.
Yeah.
It's just too, it's not enough depth.
Right. I want to talk about, again, going back to yes or no, even though it was such a better process for you and you had found your voice to some extent, and it was such a, despite the difficult circumstances you wrote it in, you had found this kind of new maturity as a writer. You still have a whole lot of self-doubt and you still continue to sort of not fully inhabit the role of capital W writer to the
Oh,
extent
yes.
that
Yeah.
when that book was nominated for the Trillium Prize for poetry, and we were both at the gala evening event when it was about to be announced, I leaned over to you maybe 3 minutes or maybe even less, maybe like 90 seconds before they announced the winner and said, you should have a speech ready. And you looked at me like I was telling you you should go and do cartwheels or something, or lift up your dress or something.
That's what I should have done.
You thought I was being absurd, just saying like, yeah, you should have a victory speech ready. Yeah. And finally, you did write something on a, you know, placemat or something.
On a napkin. I wrote a couple things, a couple point forms.
You wrote a couple things on a napkin. I think we still have the napkin somewhere, don't
you
we?
You probably do. you're the archivist, not me.
But that also speaks to this sense of, you know, you couldn't possibly be the one to win the prize. And yet I was sitting there thinking, like, I think it's going to be you. Just knowing that book and knowing how special that book is. And then following that win, a lot of writers who are very savvy about career building would have spent a lot of time building on it.
Yeah.
And yet I think people approached you to do things, to commission work. And in a lot of cases, I think you sort of ignored it or were not able to. What do you think, looking back now, years later, what do you think that was that you weren't able to jump on it?
Oh, okay. That's a tough question.
I mean, there was a lot going on in that period.
There's a lot going on, I think, in our lives. But then I think in all honesty, I know this will sound odd, but I felt really like that continuation of never feeling like what you do is good enough, right? Like there's nothing is ever good enough. And I guess there was that. And then my feeling also that likely it was some kind of oversight or mistake. And it's a continuation of, you know, that self-doubt and that sort of impostery kind of, I know that almost seems like everybody says imposter syndrome these days, but I felt ashamed in some ways. I felt like a deep kind of shame that I wasn't good enough to be recognized. And as a result, I think I couldn't enjoy it. And that's, you know, something that's inside of me that I think I need to work on, right? Because one should enjoy those kind of moments. Those are the great moments in life that, you know, sort of buoy us up and keep us going. And it's not to say I'm not a dark, miserable person by any stretch, but when it comes to, and I'm so happy for other people when they have great wins and things go well for them. But when it comes to myself, I've always had a really hard time allowing myself to enjoy good moments. I think because I've read a lot about this kind of thinking and whatnot. And I think part of it is, you know, goes back to just the way my brain is wired, which I can't necessarily always control. But if you enjoy those moments, well, when will the other shoe drop, right? Like it can't really.
Yeah.
If you start to sort of get a little bit cocky or anything and be like, oh, you know, things are going so well, then something else will fall out from underneath you. And it's similar to like people who have OCD and there's magical thinking that they do. And they think that if they, you know, say a prayer 10 times before the person they love the most gets on the highway to drive somewhere, then they'll be safe. And if they don't do that, well, everything will fall apart. And I think I have that kind of wiring to a certain extent that I feel like if maybe I don't enjoy things, then I haven't, you know, jinxed myself or anyone else around me. It's silly. It sort of makes me a little embarrassed to admit, but I think that's the truth. That's the truth.
I think that's very true. I think there's also something else going on a more superficial level, which is it relates to I think one of the hardest times you've ever made me laugh.
What's that?
and it was accidental. Uh-huh. And it was, I think it was last year, we were watching that show Mayor of Easttown with Kate Winslet.
Uh-huh. Oh, I love her.
And the Kate Winslet character encounters Guy Pearce's character. And he says, he's a visiting professor, creative writing professor. And he says, well, I'm a novelist.
Oh, yeah.
Instantly, you just slumped and went, oh, just you had this instant physical reaction to this guy declaring he's written a novel, a serious novel. And he's here to teach creative writing. And I remember howling and howling at that because I don't think you were even conscious that you were doing it. You just
probably not.
I feel like that's a figure you've encountered many times in your life.
Oh, yeah. I, I've spent my life working for, like, not now, but in a way, even because I work with students, working for other writers. And I've put up with all manner of nonsense. I'm reading right now, like Casey Plett's long form essay on community. And there is, community is great, but, and I know we all need it, of course, but I don't know that everyone who writes needs it all of the time, right? And I don't know that it's what makes you necessarily a better writer. I'm not a person who craves like a lot of social attention at all. I like my circle of people. And then even if I pop on social media and I see like someone posting like "am writing," I'm like, oh, for God's sakes, like, good grief, like, just get on with it. I'm like, do we really need to know? Like, and I know that like that's a beautiful thing and it's connection, and then people will say yay and keep going, and that's part of what spurs certain people on. But I just maybe there's just something that's really cynical about me or something. Like, just like, get down to the work now. Come on. Not everybody needs to know everything. It's probably just something about how I was like brought up.
Well, seeing it as work, seeing it as work you do, as opposed to just, communing with the muse or something, or
Yeah, and it's hard, really painful work sometimes, and sometimes awful. I mean, obviously there's something I enjoy about it. I really do. And it certainly calms my brain and makes me feel, good. Like, it makes me feel like I've achieved something, but it's hard. And I think we all wonder why the heck we do it a lot of the time.
so going to the period since yes or no.
The period, the years, the near decade.
Well, we did say that there's a lot going on. I mean, you shifted jobs a couple of times in that period.
Moved a few times.
You moved a few times.
Lost
We
some really
have a
good friends, all kinds of things.
little guy growing up, and we did lose some friends. And I just want to talk on that. About that a little bit, because you mentioned Priscilla Apple. Priscilla was one of the friends we lost in that period, as well as Tava Harrison, in a remarkably short time between those two losses, and in a weird, not particularly coincidence, but a weird sort of echo, you worked on their final books with both of them. Shortly before they died, and in fact, books that both came out after their death. I honestly feel like the combination of those two close friends dying, and then the work you did with them, and attaching it to my own illness back then, that probably produced a lot of trauma that has been a big part of the why you, has prevented you from completing a new book.
Oh yeah, I think that well, I remember saying to you, because Priscilla had asked me to help edit her last book. She wasn't feeling great, and I don't know that the publisher was being as responsive as they needed to be, and maybe it was that everyone was in some kind of denial that she was actually going to die. So she had asked if I would help, and I started working on the edits with her. And I remember Stuart Ross helped as well too, but I was going in and out of the hospital and sort of helping with things. And then it came out after, and it was. And then I remember saying to you, when Tava asked me to edit her book, I was afraid that she might die too. And you had said to me, no, she's going to be okay. It won't happen again. And it did. And so, I'm not blaming you in any way. No, I'm so glad I did it. I'm so glad I worked on both of the books. I think it gutted me in some ways, though, because I wanted them to be there for the publication of both of those books. They should have been there for the publication of both of those books. And I was so worried that, and there was, of course, like, tons of people helping and so much great support. And both of those women were loved more than anyone you can even imagine, and rightfully so. So it was certainly not just my undertaking. I want to make that clear, but I think that I felt a responsibility, and I was so concerned that I wasn't doing their work enough, like, the justice, right? And honoring it in the way that it should have been. And I think it took a piece out of me for a while. It made it so that I didn't want to even go near any of that stuff for a time. Yet when I'm not writing, I'm also really yearning for it, and I feel really not like myself. I think I'm more like myself, more grounded, more balanced, just able to be happier when I'm writing. And I don't think it's any like coincidence that my new book, which I am almost done, it's another book of poems, is called Make It Stop. And I think it's in reaction to some, just wanting to stop certain things and not being able to at all. You hear those kids sometimes when they get hurt and they're screaming in the playground, "Make it stop." And I feel like that's sometimes, at certain times how I was feeling at that time, a kind of desperate kind of sorrow, right? Grief.
In as much as you can step outside a little bit in terms of this new work, do you see that your voice has shifted again, or is it a continuation of where you were with Yes or Nope, or is it how different is it?
What I can tell, because I've been working on it a while now, it's a little more serious in tone. There's still a lot of humor and whatnot. I hate to use this word, but maybe it's a little more philosophical. But I think that that would be a fair assessment. A lot more questioning that's happening in the work, which I'm enjoying, and I am using different forms, but they're the forms that I really enjoy using. I feel like I'm at a point too where I want to offer some gratitude to some of the writers that have really informed what my understanding of poetry is. Yeah, so I'm enjoying the process of this one, but it is a little bit more serious, I have to say.
I always got the sense, I'll say this, that people didn't take you seriously enough as a writer. And partly it was your subject matter, which was not some 19th century obscure literary figure, or you weren't basing poems on scientific, theory.
Some of the work's a little trashy, maybe you could say,
Yeah.
which is completely fine.
But also just in the way you present yourself in public when you would do a reading or, be out in the world, you
I'm a
don't.
bit of a goof. But that's what I mean. Do we want everyone to just be like that kind? I mean, I look around, like, there's that kind of poet, right? Like, so you get up and you're serious, and I don't know. I don't think there's anything wrong with being a bit of a goof, being sometimes a bit of a mess, and writing about people who are goofs and messes. And but yeah, I and this is not to say like there is like the same kind of thread in the work. Like, I have a whole haiku series, which is just rotten in many ways, right? And I think I often write things and I know they're funny, but after a point I forget they're funny because I've just been so close to it for a while. And then you'll read it and I'll hear you snicker, right? And I'll be like, oh yeah, that was sort of funny, right? But it's always that very dark kind of like, oh my gosh, like you have to look away a bit.
Yeah, I should say I didn't mean to sound like I was criticizing your public persona
Oh, I
because,
don't mind.
I mean, it's a big part of the reason why I fell in love with you is because you're a brilliant goof. Like you have those two sides.
Yeah, and I don't want to spend my whole life not being who I am. Like, we all have personalities and natures, and I think that the more we embrace those, the better. And I think I don't really want to spend my life pretending I'm some kind of serious intellectual. I am smart. I know that. I've always been smart. But I remember when I was like in grade school or something, and there was this notorious family of very bright people. And I came home from school and it said, so and so has been declared gifted. And I guess that's everyone in the family now. My dad said, "Oh, for gosh sakes, give me a break. Four child's gifted." I remember thinking, well, I think my mom said, "Well, I guess we know why our children are gifted." I love where I come from, and I love the people I come from. And part of our, being goofy and humorous and silly and messy, and it's just part of who we are.
On behalf of everybody who loved all of your books, but especially Yes or No, it's delightful to know that you're almost finished a new one and there's going to be more work. And I mean that sincerely. I think there's more people than you know who've been waiting a long time for this and will be delighted. You're going to laugh it off. I think there are a lot of people, more than you know. And part of the reason you don't know is because you never got a royalty sheet from your old publisher.
No,
so you don't know
sure.
How many people have that book. But there's a lot of people out there who love that book. On behalf of them and behalf of myself, we're delighted there's a new one coming. You're also easier to live with when you're writing a lot.
I know. It's true. So are you.
What Happened Next is produced and edited by me. The music playing under my voice is by the great Alex Lukaszewski, who is letting me use it for free. You can find more of Alex's music at alukaszewski.bandcamp.com. Thank you for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. There will be a new episode every Monday. Please buy more books, and not just new ones.